The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is Mindy Weinstein, author of The Power of Scarcity, Leveraging Urgency and Demand to Influence Customer Decisions, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which has been named as one of the top marketing podcasts by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message that you're a listener, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. This episode is sponsored by Marketing Architects, creators of the all-inclusive TV advertising concept that's so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. I'll tell you more and how to get a copy of the book in a few minutes. Now, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Mindy Weinstein to talk about her book, The Power of Scarcity, Leveraging Urgency and Demand to Influence Customer Decisions, published by McGraw-Hill. Dr. Mindy Weinstein is the founder and CEO of the digital marketing firm Market Mindshift, as well as a keynote speaker, trainer, and digital marketing strategist. She has trained thousands of professionals from organizations of all sizes, including Facebook and the Weather Channel. She has a PhD in psychology and is a marketing instructor at Grand Canyon University and the University of Denver, as well as a program leader for the Wharton School and Columbia Business School. Mindy has often appeared in the media with interviews on Fox, NBC, ABC, and Bloomberg Radio. She's also been quoted in the Huffington Post and the Washington Post, amongst others. And interesting fact, at home, she uses the principles of scarcity to convince her husband and two boys to take on household chores they wouldn't have otherwise done. Mindy, congratulations on The Power of Scarcity and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So do tell. Tell us about the scarcity principles that you use to get your husband and boys to do household chores. This will probably be the most helpful thing in the whole interview.
I know. I was just thinking, like, I hope, you know, maybe I'll tell them to, like, skip in this podcast ahead so they don't know what I've been doing to them. But here's the thing. I'll just put it this way. My husband has made comments to me that he's like, I don't understand. I'll be doing the laundry and I'm excited about it. And he goes, and I know that has to do with those principles you're using on me. So it's all about the wording, how you word things.
The framing. Yes.
The framing. Yes,
that's
absolutely
right. Wow. So now, are you also a licensed clinical therapist?
I am not. So I have a PhD in general psychology.
Okay.
So research on the research side.
Oh, well, I was kind of hoping you'd be a licensed clinical therapist so we could talk about your book for about 5 minutes and then work through issues that I have. But oh, well.
That would be great. And I could still give you advice. It just probably is not going to be very helpful.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, now, speaking of scarcity, it's my understanding that you are only going to be on one podcast to be interviewed about your book. So I'm really excited that you picked the Marketing Book Podcast. Is that right?
You have exclusivity. Absolutely.
That's right. That's right.
For a limited time.
Yes, for a limited time. And it's also my understanding there are only going to be a very limited number of this book available for purchase. Is that right?
Yeah. So there's only a few copies left. So you got to act now.
Okay. Okay. Well, folks, that is not what we're going to be talking about. So there's a whole lot more to it. I want to read an excerpt from the introduction and then talk about scarcity. This is on page XII, which is page 13 for the listeners in Rome. Scarcity is a rarely discussed but incredibly powerful principle. When applied correctly, it can boost sales, win negotiations, ignite action, develop community, build customer loyalty, and create fun and excitement. Scarcity has been identified as one of several principles of influence. And out of all the influence principles, scarcity is one of the most powerful because it involves primal instincts that are key to survival. Our ancestors had to survive when scarcity was prevalent. While we might not need to hunt and gather scarce resources like our ancestors did, that instinct hasn't gone away. We still experience the feeling of loss and regret if we don't get our hands on a scarce product or service. The urgency to take action becomes overwhelming. This book is all about the concept of scarcity, but not from an economic point of view. Yes, scarcity is at the heart of economics, the principle of supply and demand. Scarcity also exists in the world of psychology, and it is a reason behind many of the purchases we make. It is also the catalyst for increased sales for businesses and thus higher revenues. If used correctly, scarcity can influence the people who use your products or services. Now, Mindy, before we started recording, you mentioned that there are a lot of misperceptions of scarcity, and people are a little confused when you tell them you've written a book about scarcity. Let's clear things up here.
Yeah, and that is something that I'm glad we're addressing right away. It was really interesting. So when I was working on the book, so in the process of writing and researching, you know, I would tell people, you know, colleagues, friends, clients, you know, I'm working on a book about scarcity and specifically how it impacts businesses and how it can be used effectively in marketing. And there is a very common response that I would get. And it usually was something to the effect of, oh, are you talking about those emails that I get that say flash sale today only, you're gonna miss out forever? I mean, I'm adding the last part to it, but they would give those type of examples.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, even how we were joking in the beginning when we started, and I was saying, you know, act now, those kind of things, scarcity is a lot more complex than that. So in that example that people would throw out at me, that's one type or one category of scarcity, and that's only really one example within that category. Mm-hmm. There are so many layers of scarcity, and they different types work in different ways. And that's what I discovered as I was working on my PhD, which led me to writing this book, because it even opened my eyes. All of a sudden, I started realizing, I think I make a lot of decisions based on this scarcity principle, and I didn't even know that. So just understanding that it's a lot deeper and more complex, and there's a lot of different things you can do, not just the buy now, flash sale. Right. Again, that's just one type.
Yeah, and also in the introduction, you wrote, now for all those listeners who think, mm-hmm. yeah, well, I don't fall for that, oh, you have no idea. Even Dr. Weinstein wrote, even yes. as an experienced marketer with a PhD in psychology, I fall for scarcity tactics more often than I care to admit.
Yes.
So, yeah, it works. It works. Can you talk about the effect that scarcity has on our brains, just to set the stage here?
Yes, absolutely. And this is really what caught my attention and what made me want to study and understand scarcity even more. You know, as the excerpt that you read from the book, it's primal. And influence, if you know the influence factors, I mean, scarcity is one of the identified factors, as you mentioned, that's in the book. However, because it is so strong and has such a huge impact on our brain activity, it is really one of the most powerful forces when it comes to those decision-making, you know, aspects and influence. So what happens in the brain? And this is what is just fascinating. So there have been multiple studies and research done that really looks at brain scans. I'll just tell you, it's hard to argue with brain activity. You know, you can say things like, well, I'm not sure about those survey results or that questionnaire or that interview. But when we're talking about the brain and the activity lighting up, that's a little more difficult to try to say it's not true. So there has been, like I said, multiple studies. So in one research study, we're able to see that when people were exposed to scarcity, and I'm not talking about scarcity where they felt like they weren't going to have access to water or food or shelter. I'm talking about not being able to buy a product. Mm-hmm. So when people were faced with those conditions, they were hooked up to MRIs. So again, brain scan. And in those situations, what would happen is the part of the brain that deals with valuation processes, meaning how do we value something, that part of the brain would instantly start to light up, meaning that what the brain was doing is it was looking at something that was scarce and automatically assigning that a higher value. So scarcity equals value. And that's one of the things that I talk about in my book. But there's another very important takeaway from a different study that I want to mention, and it also involved MRIs, and so brain scans. And this particular study showed that when people were faced, again, with a scarce condition, also not talking about something essential for survival. You know, we're talking about products here and online shopping. Those
calm
kind of
down,
things.
Everybody.
Yeah. So I'm not talking about we're going to withhold something to help you really, truly survive. But what was happening in those scans is that the part of the brain that deals with decision-making lit up right away. And researchers were able to see that the normal process that the brain would take when making a decision was actually skipped. So those steps were skipped and it was like instant decision. This is urgent. It needs my attention, decision right away. So we know also that when we're faced with scarcity, our brains kick into gear and it's very urgent and we need to make a decision. Mm-hmm. That's how our brains operate. And it goes back to the primal part of things and our ancestors.
Yes. And we're going to talk a bit about how it gives us mental shortcuts. I want to quote from page 15 just to finish this off, where you write, "Our brains are hardwired for survival, which is why we often focus on what we don't have. Scarcity causes our brain to shift its focus onto what it considers urgent. If there is something we really want to buy that's also hard to get, our brains shift into gear and place mental energy and focus on rectifying the decision. Because from our mind's perspective, this need is now urgent." Now, I want to fast forward from our cave-dwelling ancestors to the modern day and ask you to explain something from page 10. And I'm saying the pages for the not for the author, because I know a lot of listeners get the book and follow along. Explain what you mean when you write that the effect that scarcity has now is caused by a combination of deep-rooted instincts and modern challenges.
Right. So we still have, like I put in the book, we still have those instincts. And modern challenges is, I mean, you even think about today. I mean, sometimes we have supply shortages. Sometimes we're faced with a situation where it's a product, but it's very limited time. And so modern challenges, when I'm talking about that, I'm still talking about in, you know, the commerce setting type of thing. But what also happens is because we are now in a situation where we can always see what's happening, meaning like social media, there's posts of this product that's running out of stock, or there's an influencer talking about his or her favorite product and boom, it's sold out. So we're very, very much aware. So we already have these instincts and then now we're very aware. Again, we know sometimes there are supply shortages, those kind of things. Those have carried over, of course, throughout the years. So it just makes us even more hyper aware and understanding like, okay, we need to take advantage or make a decision right away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our prehistoric brain is getting a little mixed up in all these suddenly very modern things because I guess the evolution of the brain, what's happened in the last 200 years is like 5 minutes ago. So, but I learned so much, and I should share with the listener that you're in Arizona, where Dr. Yes. Cialdini lives, and he's the author of Influence, the Psychology of Persuasion, and you've become friends with him. And so that gives you mad street cred with Marketing Book Podcast listeners. But I've gotten to interview him a couple times, and he's just wonderful. And also, I think he has a great sense of humor. So the reason I mention him, I'm sorry, is that in his book, scarcity is one of the six or now seven biggest influencers. And yet, I thought, oh, I already know about scarcity. No, I didn't. Like you said, it's much more complicated. And there's a lot of times where it could be done very wrong. And so I want to dig into that. But one of the many things I learned about scarcity is that, and I'd like you to explain, is that you say that as powerful as scarcity is, it is a force that is extremely fragile. What do you mean by fragile?
Yes. And so that was another thing. So as I was doing my studies and, you know, researching and testing, is that as powerful as scarcity can be. It doesn't mean that we're like in robotic mode and something's scarce and we're just going to make a decision right away. I mean, we still are intelligent beings. And so what happens...
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So what happens is when a company continues to use the same tactic, which, you know, we'll get into the different types of scarcity, but they continue to use the same thing over and over and over again. Well, customers after a while are going to go, wait a minute, you know, this isn't authentic. What's going on here? They start to devalue even the product or the service. Then there's other times where, you know, scarcity might be completely fabricated. Well, we live in an age where we can figure that out. There's online reputation. There's things like that. And so it can completely backfire. And so it becomes very fragile. And then the other thing about it is that there are the different types of scarcity and they don't work for everybody. So there's some types that are going to work for people who have certain needs and others that it's actually going to turn them off. And so you have to understand that. And that's why I call it fragile, because if you do it wrong or if you use an inappropriate type of scarcity for a certain customer, then you're really not going to see the results and it actually might do the opposite.
Yes, absolutely. And just to break the news to the audience.
Let's talk about something important.
Consumers are not as stupid as a lot of companies think they are, okay? So, well, that really resonated with me when it said it's very fragile because, you know, people are not idiots. They can see through this. And you have several examples in the book about how companies do it wrong. Oh, boy, you got my blood boiling there. But let's just a couple other fundamentals here. And this is what helped me a lot is on, you write on page 26 that our reaction to scarcity isn't because we desire freedom. It's because we fear its loss.
Right.
Yeah. Please unwind that one for me.
Yes. And so that is also just, again, something just so eye-opening about it. And all of what we're talking about, I mean, this is how the brain is working, yes. You know? And so when, you know, I'll talk a little bit about gain and a little bit about loss. Mm-hmm. But I do even just want to give an example just to kind of set the stage here, and then we'll get into loss and gain. I mean, if anyone has teenagers, or we've all been teenagers, so we've all can say that at least, you know that if you tell a teenager, no, you can't have that, that makes them want it more. That's just the way it goes. And so that's actually falls within something referred to as reactance theory.
And Dr. Weinstein, be glad you don't have a teenage daughter, okay?
I do have teenage boys. Yes. And so I'm trying to survive that at the moment for sure. And again, I can't really like divulge some of the things that I've done with them on scarcity and all that, but yeah, it works with teenagers.
Well, for sure. Mindy, if your kids or husband are like my spouse or family, they're not going to listen to this. I mean, my wife doesn't even know I have a podcast, so...
Oh, I love it. I did have people ask me, you know, when my book came out, like, oh, are your boys so proud and excited? I'm like, I don't think they really care. Yeah. I mean, I'm just mom, so yeah. nothing special there.
Yeah, I think to my kids, we're just an ATM machine.
That too, for sure, for sure.
So you're going to talk about loss and gain, and then maybe you could cap it off with an explanation of reactance.
Yes. Okay. So let's go with loss and gain. And so this is also based on psychological research. The feelings that we have when we gain something are actually not as strong as the feelings we have when we lose something. And that might sound very odd, but this is the scenario I like everyone to think of, because we've all been here before. You know, you're walking in a parking lot, let's say, and you find a $20 bill on the ground. Like, that's exciting. You look around, there's no one there. So you're like, okay, I get to keep this $20. Like, you just gained something. You're excited. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt you're excited. But we've also all been in the situation where we've misplaced a $20 bill. Maybe it fell out of our pocket. We can't find it. It fell out of our wallet. Who knows? But that feeling of loss is actually going to be a lot stronger. And part of that is, again, because of how we're wired. We, from our ancestors, they were trying to avoid loss, trying to survive. And that's still how we are today. We don't want to lose anything. So when we get in a situation where something is scarce, so a product is running out of stock, or it's a limited edition, so it's not going to be around that long. It could be there's just a supply shortage. We don't want to lose our opportunity to make that purchase. And so that's going to also drive us. You know, and the buzzword we hear, of course, in, you know, everyday language is FOMO, but FOMO is really based on loss aversion. And so that's really where that comes from. And it's actually a big part of what makes scarcity so strong and such a huge influence factor on us. Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to reactance theory, it's really very much in line with that. So if you feel like we're going to lose something, so lose the freedom to buy something, to attend a concert, well, we are going to react to that. And that's where I made the joke about the teenagers, because it's the same idea. React. Well, if you're told no, like now you really want this because like you want that option available to you. And so we do react. And again, that's reactance theory. And that's been studied a lot throughout the years within psychology. But all of that plays into this. And again, what makes scarcity work within the business setting?
Whenever you give examples related to teenagers and I laugh, I'm laughing to keep from crying because I know exactly what you're talking about. TV advertising is a powerful channel for business growth, and it's a counterintuitive solution for businesses frustrated by the rising costs of digital marketing. But the traditional process for launching TV campaigns is expensive, time-consuming, and complex. That's why marketing architects flip the traditional process on its head. With all-inclusive TV advertising, they invest their own money to produce, analyze, and optimize your TV campaign. All you pay for is media, setting you up for rapid growth at a significant cost advantage. This approach to TV is so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. It's called All-Inclusive TV, How Booming Brands Are Reimagining TV Advertising. It explores how a variety of brands are using TV to transform their businesses and how you can do the same. For a copy of the book, visit this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com or visit marketingarchitects.com/book and tell them you heard about it on the Marketing Book Podcast. One of the many Marketing Book Podcast listeners is Steve Scheinkopf, and he is the CEO of Yale Appliance. And if there are any listeners in the Boston area who need appliances, you need to go to Yale Appliance and ask for the Marketing Book Podcast special. Now, I don't know what that special is, but just ask for it, because Steve is such an avid listener to the Marketing Book Podcast that, first off, he's not paid to be a sponsor of this show, just so you know. But he did send me several bottles of wine. And if anyone else wants to send me, you know, a few bottles of wine, I'm not going to stop you. But he was complaining this week about my podcast because he's buying too many books. He's spending too much money on books. I couldn't resist. I had to call him and say, Steve, you have no idea. Wait until you get hold of this scarcity book. It's got retailers written all over it. And so as a result, I was wondering if you could touch on, for the sake of Steve, who I should add is he's a very good looking guy because, you know, he's a Marketing Book Podcast listener. How do retailers use the concept of reactance to their advantage?
Yes. And so I would love, once we get into the different types of scarcity, I can give even more examples. Mm-hmm. But really with reactance, being told no, I mean, you're not going to have a customer walk in and you're like, sorry, you can't buy that. The answer is no. I mean, you're not going to do that. That's not what I'm talking about here. But you can show if something like one of your products has been restocked, you know, putting on a label that says restocked or only so many units left, or letting people know that this has been a popular item that we have had a hard time keeping in our store. And we'll see if I have time to share. I have actually an embarrassing example of me doing that.
I have plenty of audio tape, Dr. Weinstein.
Okay. But it works. It works on us too. And so scarcity. Okay, I'll just give my really short example then on this because it actually does apply. And as I said, I'm not above saying that I don't fall for scarcity. I research, I write about it. I'm a marketer. But I feel like that also shows how really effective it is that it can still work. Doesn't matter sometimes the head knowledge, but the very short version, I was at Total Wine, and this was actually a few months ago. So I live in Arizona.
I thought I liked you, But now...
Now that I'm talking about Total Wine, even more so. So I was at, so again, Arizona gets a little toasty in the summer. And my husband and I were at Total Wine, and I was looking for white wine to make sangria. And he went off, you know, down one of the rows, and I was just standing there, and it's overwhelming. And see, this is actually part of how scarcity can even work. It's overwhelming. There's so many choices. I don't know what to pick. I didn't really go in having one in mind. I just knew what type, Sauvignon Blanc. That's what I knew I wanted. And so as I was standing there, a salesperson walked by, and what had happened before she had walked by is I picked up a bottle because there was a sign that said something about best wine for the, or best value for the price, or I don't remember exactly how it worded it. So I picked it up and I was holding it, but it was only a $5 bottle of wine. So I was a little skeptical, and I'm not a wine snob. Like there's Trader Joe wine that I like that is like very inexpensive, but this one I didn't know was $5. And so the saleswoman walks by and stops and says, "Oh, I'm surprised we have any of that left in the store." And I said, "Really? Why?" She goes, "Because we keep selling out, and I don't know if we're going to keep it in stock." And then she goes, "Yeah, just this morning," she goes, "a woman called. She'd been calling all the different Total Wines wanting to know if we had any left. And her husband came and bought 2 cases of it." And I'm like, "Really?" And then she walks away. So now I'm like, well, that's interesting. So now I want it more, because now I'm thinking, oh, what if I don't buy it and I try to come back and it's not there? Like, my freedom to buy this wine is gone.
That would be loss.
Then it would be lost. Then another salesperson, because I still was kind of on the fence, walks by and says kind of the same thing. He goes, "Yeah." He goes, "I'm surprised we even have that available." And he goes, and I made a joke about the price. He's like, "Yeah, it probably should be more money because it's really good wine." And then he walks away. So no joke, this is what I did. I find my husband and I go, "Okay, we're buying an entire case of this wine that I've never tried before." So not even like I tried one bottle. Entire case of wine. So we do that. And then on the way home, I'm just chatting about, if it's good, I'm going to call all the Total Wines. And I'm going to buy up all their stock, you know, of this. And we get home that night, we open it. And this is the embarrassing part. So all the listeners might think differently of me at this point in time and might tune out. But we open the bottle of wine, we each take a sip. And I go, "So what do you think?" He's like, "It's all right for white wine." He's like, "But I don't really like white wine." I'm like, "You know, me neither." Okay, so why am I crazy? I only drink white wine and sangria, but yet I got so caught up in this whole frenzy, and then I bought a wine I would never even buy, and I bought a whole case. So the case is still sitting downstairs. You know, I'm sure it's good for white wine, but I always put a bunch of things in it for sangria. But that shows the power. And here I know what's going on, but let me break it down so we can like make this actionable for everyone. So I'm standing there. It has a label that marked it already as a good value. So doing that in a commerce setting, that's great, you know, because it caught my attention. I had so many choices available. Then hearing from a salesperson that this is very popular, I'm surprised we even have it in stock. Well, now my decision-making, I've skipped steps because I had all these options. Now I'm honed in to this one option. And then when the next salesperson, not that you have to have multiple salespeople saying this, but when they even just reinforce the fact that this is a very popular best-selling wine that is in high demand, my decision was made. It was made by then. I wasn't going to look at any of the other options available. I was hyper-focused. I wanted to make sure I got this. So that just shows, I know it's a goofy example, but it just shows how it works.
Mm. Well, so if anyone's going to send wine to Dr. Weinstein, don't send her Sauvignon Blanc. Is that the, yes, she has plenty of that.
I prefer cabs, but you know, reds would be good.
Oh, so do I. Yeah, Cabernet Sauvignon. Yes, and then that's what I like. And also, if you're any listeners in the Phoenix area, feel free to drop by for a drink of that particular wine.
Yeah, because sure I have a lot of it.
Yeah. Help her out. So the only other thought that comes to mind, and again, there's no charge for these ideas, but if your husband were to have pushed back while you were in the wine store about you buying a case of it, you could say, "Honey, this is for research." Okay.
I could have. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. You're welcome. So there's just a couple other quick definitions I wanted to get out of the way.
Yes.
Can you talk about priming and how the priming the message can strengthen or weaken the reaction to scarcity?
Right. So we have to be in the right mindset when it comes to scarcity. And so priming really has to do with what is your customer exposed to beforehand. And so there has been a lot of research done on priming. And so the one that I included in the book actually had to do with a research study of when certain messages were scheduled as commercials. And so this is what is really interesting. So when it came to a programming that was more of, you know, like a movie that was a love story and more romantic, then having a commercial where you are using a scarcity message that is more on the supply related, meaning if you buy this, it's not like everyone can have it. It's like more exclusive. It could sell out. It could even be a limited edition. It could be one of those things, but you would stand out. And I'm going to get into this explanation in a second. So hold that in your mind.
Okay.
Then in this research, we also were seeing that if it was something that was more of like a crime drama or something that was scary, then the type of commercial, if you're going to use scarcity, you would use demand-related scarcity, meaning that a lot of people have this product, it's really popular, you're kind of fitting with the herd, basically. And so why would that be? So those ones tended to be more effective if it was demand-related during the crime-type shows or things that were scary versus supply-related was more popular and better when it came to like the romantic side. Mm-hmm. And here's why. Because with demand-related scarcity, again, you are conforming. It means a lot of people have it. So you, like, mentally in our brains, if there is a killer on the loose or there's someone we're prey by any chance, like, we want to be part of a group. We do not want to stand out. Like, we don't want to have that, like, that luxury item that no one else has or that fancy whatever or, like, just something that's going to draw attention to us. We do not want to stand out. We want to be like everybody else. We want to be part. We want to be in the middle of that herd just trying to hide. Now, with supply-related, that's really showing uniqueness and you'd want to stand out because you're buying something that not everyone else has. So in a romantic setting, when you're already primed that way and you're thinking like that, you're like, well, you want to stand out from everyone to a possible significant other. And so it's just very interesting because it shows that even those little things like that make an impact on how effective our messages will be.
Yeah. And you wrote about how a sense of danger can reduce mm-hmm. the effectiveness of scarcity messages. So one other quick couple of things I want to get out of the way. One is, I've seen this. Every one of these stories you tell here, it's like, oh yeah, I've seen this or I've seen my wife, you know, fall prey to this. What mm-hmm. Talk about how scarcity breeds this competition.
Oh, yes. Okay. So that's a big one. So with scarcity—
I think that was the story where you were at Disney World or something.
Oh, yes. Okay, and I could give the short version. Again, I feel like this is now my therapy session.
It's not like a fight broke out or anything, but it was...
No, I didn't fight with anyone physically at Disney World, but it was just basically just understanding competition. So that's another thing that we've identified when there's something is scarce is that you're in competition. Yeah. So if it's something that's a high demand, you're competing with other people to get that service, to get on that wait list, to buy that product.
Or like an eBay auction maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. eBay, all that, you're in competition. You know, Black Friday, Cyber Monday. I mean, those are all like huge examples, of course, of competition because there's, you know, other people are going to buy and you're in competition with them. But even time-related scarcity, when it's something like you're on a website and it's a countdown timer, you're competing still. You're now just competing with the clock is the difference. And so the example that I gave in the book was another personal example. And I was at Disney World with my family and it was during the pandemic, but the park had reopened, but they had a lot of restrictions in place on, you know, the rides and those kind of things. And so my kids really wanted to get on the ride. It's called Rise of the Resistance. So any Star Wars fans, which my family is, you know, that is definitely something that would catch your interest. But I didn't know much about it. All I knew about it was that to ride it, you had to get on the list, and you would do that through the app, the Disney World app, the list to be able to get called to get in line. So like you would get assigned a number. It's like, okay, no big deal. So I looked it up and at 8 a.m. and I think it was at 1 p.m. or around there. But, you know, I'm in Arizona, I'm on the East Coast, so I'm still trying to get used to the time. But I woke up, I set my alarm, and right at 8 a.m. Eastern time, I had the app open and I pressed the button to join the list. And right away, I got a message that said the list was already full. Please try again this afternoon.
Yes.
And I. And now, talking about hyper-focus, this isn't key to my survival to go on this ride, but my brain doesn't know that. So now my brain is saying, this is urgent. So I started to hyper focus on it. So we get to the park, and that's all I could think about is we get to the park. And right when we get there, I tell my husband and boys, like, I need to find the place that has the highest or the best Wi-Fi so that when I need to try again this afternoon to get on the list, I have a better chance. And they're like, okay, you know. So that's all I thought about all morning was like, I wonder if we're going to be able to get on this time. I wonder if we're going to be able to get on. So I was so hyper focused on it. So the time came, I was, you know, in this area with good Wi-Fi, but apparently other people had scoped out that area too. And so there's a lot of us. I click the button and I get a message that I was put on a wait list to be on the list. So I was on a list to be on the list. And I don't know if that was more frustrating or exciting. Like, it just was kind of like, oh, so now I don't know what's going to happen. But all around me, there were people either cheering or booing because they were all trying to get on the list. So now I've spent the rest of the day hyper-focusing on, I wonder if we're going to get on. I wonder if we're going to get on. Well, we ended up, we actually did get to, on the list, and we had our number. So we, when we're called, we get in this long line still to get on. And I finally looked at my oldest son and I said, what happened? Like, why did we do this? And he said, well, because everyone else wanted to get on or something to that effect, mm-hmm. you know, and I have it in my book, his exact words. And I remember thinking to myself, I just fell for exactly what I study, you know, and I fell into all this. And I can't even tell you about the rest of the day at the park. I don't even know what we rode. I only remember that one ride, but it was a good ride for the record.
Yeah, and your sons probably had a great time.
Oh, they had a great time. They weren't stressed about it.
No, not at all. Not at all. So one other thing, I know I keep saying one other thing, but there's a couple things I wanted to get out of the way that just blew me away. One, and we touched on this already, talk about how – you know, scarcity can lead to mental shortcuts. In other words, scarcity actually helps give our brains a break.
Yes. And this is huge. And so in my embarrassing example of the wine, I mean, that's what was happening is I was taking a mental shortcut because now my decision was pretty much made for me. This was popular, you know? And so here's what happens. As I mentioned with one of those brain scans, scarcity, there's really an equation. Scarcity equals value. I mean, that's what it does. And that's how our brains work. It equals value. So when something is scarce, we automatically assign a higher value to it. So especially in a situation where something is scarce, let's say because of high demand, what we're going to do is we're going to take a mental shortcut. So here's an example. Let's say you're at the grocery store and you're buying a product you've never purchased before. It's in a category you don't really know. So you're at the grocery store, and we've all been here. You know, you're looking at the shelves and there's all these different options. Now, one of the brands only has one or two units left, but the other ones are fully stocked. And let's just say price is pretty similar. What you're going to do is you're actually just going to pick the one that only has one or two left because your brain's taking a mental shortcut. It's saying, oh, I picked that one because that many people can't be wrong. It must be pretty good. So when something is scarce, we assume it must be pretty good. And so we take that mental shortcut. And our brains, I mean, we're bombarded with information. So any kind of mental shortcut, our brain is going to take it. Mm-hmm. So that's just one of the other reasons that it really works in such an effective way.
Well, it seems to leverage our natural laziness of not wanting to have to think. Or maybe I'm just talking for myself, but
well, our brains are tired. That's the thing. I might even have that sentence there. Our brains are tired. I mean, they're just, you know, just like, what can we do to just make something quicker so we don't have to keep thinking about it.
Right.
And so that's really where that shines. But just this is a little preview as an example of that, like super easy example is if you have, let's say, an e-commerce site. Just marking a product as best seller or most popular, that allows your customers to take that mental shortcut and they're like, I will take that one.
It works on me all the time. Okay. The one thing I want to make clear though is this is page 49. I want to quote from the book. You write, if it were as simple as making something scarce or hard to get in order to make more people mindlessly want to buy, hire, date, etc., this book would be done in one chapter, maybe even less, but it's not that simple. So what are some of the basic factors that need to be present for scarcity to cause action? And the action is what's important.
Yes. And so first and foremost, it has to be true. And so, I mean, there are, you know, things, of course, you can incorporate scarcity by doing sales and things like that, but it has to be true because people can validate that. It's not hard to figure out that, oh, this company keeps saying that they're selling out, yet they're always fully stocked. I mean, we can see that. And there's, again, research to that that comes up. The other thing, which I mentioned a little bit, But there are different types of scarcity and they don't work for everybody. Mm-hmm. So you have to understand that as a marketer, as a business owner, as even a consumer, just understanding how does this work? And so you can't just say, oh, this is... So the whole most popular example I gave, well, that doesn't work for everything. You know, it's not going to work for everyone and it's not going to work for every product. So again, scarcity has to be true. We have to think about our customers and will this work for them and what we know about them. And then the other is really the product is or service. Does it work for that particular product or service? And that's really big. And then the same thing as far as like not using the exact scarcity, you know, approach over and over again, which I know I didn't mention that, mm-hmm. but that also counteracts everything. So it is a lot more that you have to think about. But I will say that, you know, as we continue to talk, it's not hard to implement the scarcity principle. You just have to go in understanding the nuances of it. And that's what we'll continue to unpack. But that's really what I meant by that statement.
Right. You know, we need to know there's a few more levers at your disposal than I think a lot of people realize.
Right.
And so I want to jump to, I'll kind of jump back to the mm-hmm. fear of missing out part to chapter 4. This is where you write about sometimes the fear of loss overshadows mm-hmm. potential gain. And then you include the following quote from Don Draper from Mad Men, which yes. I'm going to play. And I'd like you to okay. explain why you included yeah. this. Hold right. on.
Advertising is based on one thing. Happiness. And you know what happiness is? Happiness is the smell of a new car. It's freedom from fear. It's a billboard on the side of the road that screams with reassurance that whatever you're doing, it's okay. You are okay.
I love that you have the clip ready.
Yeah. So why did you tell us why you included that particular clip?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Okay. Well, one, I mean, I'm a huge Mad Men fan and it's because I teach, you know, and, but my students, they're at the point, they have no idea. When I start talking about Mad Men and Don Draper, they just look at me with this blank look. I'm like, all right, well, I'll move on.
Yeah. But here, was he in the Civil War? Yeah.
Yeah. Who's that? But that line, even he said in the middle of it, freedom from fear. We want to just know that we are okay. And that is really why I pulled that out. Because yes, with, you know, when it comes to advertising and getting products, I mean, really our drive is we do want to be happy, but we also don't want to have that fear of we can't get this or this fear of we missed out on this opportunity. And so that freedom from fear is what we're striving for, you know, and once we make our decisions that we're good, we're okay. We have that chance to buy this, hire the service, that type of thing. And so that's why I included that because it was funny because that quote came in my mind as I was working on this particular chapter. I'm like, this is so Don Draper right now. I need to incorporate him in here.
And thank you for doing it. As a former New York City Madison Avenue ad man, you scored all kinds of points with me when you included that. So let me just want to pull out one thing. Again, back to my buddy Steve Sheinkopf, mm-hmm. Yale Appliance. Why do temporary discounts tend to perform better than everyday low prices?
Yes. And so what happens with, again, with the idea of scarcity, if it's everyday low prices, there is no sense of urgency because you know that you're going to come back and that's still going to be the same price. And so while it's good, it's not necessarily going to make someone purchase right away. When it's that temporary sale, well, people know that if they don't buy this item right now, they are going to end up having to pay more later. And so it becomes urgent all of a sudden. So that's really the difference between the two.
Okay. I want to jump to chapter 5 titled, mm-hmm. When Scarcity Doesn't Work. Yeah. Talk about an attention-grabbing paragraph. I thought it worked all the time. Yeah. But it's kind of like a strong drug, you know. You have to be careful what you're doing here. When does scarcity not work? And what are examples of scarcity being used incorrectly? And I would like to say that if anyone's not been listening, please listen to this one particular yeah. part.
Right. So let me give you a few different, like, just general examples, and then mm-hmm. I can give you some more specific examples.
Sure.
So, you know, I did allude to this, but when you keep doing the same thing. So if you keep saying that you're having a flash sale, but you have a flash sale like every week and it tends to be on the same product, Or let's say you do a coupon. So right now I'm talking about time-related scarcity. So let's say you do a coupon. Well, if you have the same coupon over and over again, you actually end up devaluing that particular product because people know that, well, why would I pay full price? That's not even what this is worth. It's actually worth what the coupon is. But then there's also just completely made up scarcity, and that's a problem. And so one of the, you know, examples, and I actually, this is something that I came across as I was doing my research, is that, you know, we've been on those sites before, you know, online where it might say like, okay, there's only, you know, 5 left or 3 left. And let's say it's a site you don't really know. Well, you are trusting what you see, you know, that mm-hmm. it says how many units are left. So you make a purchase. Well, if you come back, you know, a week later, just out of curiosity, or maybe you come back even the next day and you still see that like it has the same amount left, or maybe it's just like kind of fluctuating, but in a way that doesn't seem natural, that's going to make you mistrust the site. And some people will do that with their websites, is that they'll try to say something is out of stock or running out when it really isn't. And so one of the examples I even include in the book, and it was actually a shopper that talked about that very scenario, buying, you know, makeup product on a website that she wasn't familiar with. And it said, you know, that there were so many units left. And then just out of curiosity, she ended up coming, like refreshing the page, going back.
Right.
Uh-huh. And then it showed more were left. And yeah, I understand there could be glitches. So I understand that happens. But what this particular shopper did is then she got curious and then went online like a lot of us would do and would started looking up reviews about that company. And there were a lot of complaints that people had of this company's misusing scarcity to get people to purchase. Well, in that scenario, what's going to happen is that the reputation is damaged. And we know, I mean, online reputation is a big deal that's really hard to undo. And so it's not worth that short-term gain you might do by having it be false. The other thing is, and it's actually a very complicated psychological principle, but it's persuasion and knowledge model is actually the theory.
Yeah.
Right. And so that has to do with the source of the message. Can they be trusted? And really getting into like, what do you already know as a customer? And where that comes in is, you know, does it make sense for this person or this company to be telling you something is running out of stock or there's a limited edition or that type of thing? And if there is any kind of mistrust there, that scarcity message is not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I even had, well, not I think, I know. I know I also had the example of even a younger shopper who was going to a particular store and was so excited when the store opened because it was a 50% off everything sale. Well, quickly, her and her friends realized that it's always 50% off.
Right. She was going to the beach, I think, and then came back the next week.
Yep. And it was continued. And so that type of thing, it's not going to work for the long term. And that's just, I guess, a warning for everyone. So the things that I'm teaching, they're powerful. I talked already about what happens with the brain. But if you misuse it and you're like, oh, this worked, so I'm going to keep doing the exact same thing, or I'm just going to completely make up something, that it's not sustainable because we have too much access to information. And again, people are going to be able to see right through that.
Everybody has a loudspeaker now.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. And we won't talk about it, but I just want to add to the complexity. I didn't know that the consumer's age plays a role in how they respond to scarcity. And you got to be careful there too.
Right. And that's actually, I don't mind just giving a really brief, you know, into that is that, you know, when you read that part in my book where I said that if scarcity was that simple, you know, it'd be done really quickly.
Yeah.
And I actually even had someone review my book, which was a great review that she did. And it was funny, she started out the review of, I was wondering what this author would have to say about scarcity in 185 pages. Like, what could she possibly say? But then she said, you know, but I understand it now. And so with that, like with age, we know from research that as people age, and even when they get into like more retirement years, they already have preferences and brand loyalty. So you saying that something is exclusive or limited or high demand, they don't really care because they already like what they like. And it actually, if you tell them something is in high demand, they might be like, yeah, then I don't want to go there. Like if it's a restaurant, like I'll not go there.
And I don't want to wait in line.
Yeah. So you have to think about that too.
Oh, goodness. Is it, when we get older, our ability to process information slows down. Mm-hmm. We can still interpret information and make decisions, but we can't do it at the same pace as when we were younger. And I'm going to be quoting that to my kids when they next time they come over here. So let's talk about, finally, some of the types of scarcity messages. Yes. And how to use them effectively and ethically. And there's some specific types of scarcity that we'll touch on, and you have to define, mm-hmm. you have a section in the book defining like time-related scarcity, mm-hmm. limited edition scarcity, demand-related scarcity, and supply-related scarcity. Let's start with time-related scarcity. So yes. yeah, what are the do's and don'ts and pros and cons of using time to influence people?
Right. So with time-related scarcity, that's any type of time restriction. So those could be, you know, I mentioned flash sales. I mean, that's time-related scarcity. Coupons are time-related. Countdown timers, products that are offered for a limited time, you know, even thinking about like the pumpkin spice latte, you know, those are all things that are time-related. So what happens in that situation is the customer competes with you on the time that product is available or the mm-hmm. service. And so that's time-related scarcity. Out of all the different types of scarcity, this one is the broadest in terms of the customers and the products that you might offer. It works with a lot of different types is what I'm saying here. Mm-hmm. The one exception would be luxury goods. I would not do time-related scarcity with that because it actually doesn't work as well. But those could be things like
it works better for non-conspicuous goods, right?
Non-conspicuous yeah. goods, yes. Mm-hmm. And so those are things that, you know, are our everyday products. You know, we go, there's a sale on, you know, Campbell's soup, you know, those kind of things. Mm-hmm. And so time-related works really well in those circumstances. But the warning, and it's what I've said, is that while it's great, you don't want to continue to do the exact same promotion over and over again or have the same coupon over and over again. You got to mix it up because otherwise you devalue what you're offering.
Right. And so some of the examples of limited time offers are like flash sales, countdown timers, mm-hmm. which you mentioned, and coupons. Yeah.
Yes.
Let's talk about coupons. I remember years ago when I lived in New York City, there was this Royal Canadian Pancake House. And outside it, it had a sign that said, pancakes makes people happy. So what is the psychological explanation regarding our attraction to coupons?
Oh, I'm so glad you went down this road because this is one of my favorite things. And when I tell my students, they're always looking at me in disbelief. So there has been research that has shown what happens to us when we get coupons. And so now you're already like, so what? I get a coupon. Yeah, okay. But actually, it's interesting. So there was a study done that looked at how the really the body, you know, chemicals, what happens, you know, when you get a coupon or promotion of some type. And what we found through research was that the level of oxytocin went higher when you got a coupon versus if you were, you know, cuddling, you know, having a kiss, those kind of things. Like you were actually happier. Oxytocin is the love hormone, if you're not really sure what I'm talking
about. I could not believe that you said that in the book.
Yes, I know.
I did not know the power that coupons have.
I know. So that's when I joke in class. I said, so, you know, if you're feeling bummed out, just look for a coupon. You're going to be happy. So we really like our coupons is basically what that's saying.
And what you're saying is coupons make people happy.
Coupons make people happy.
Yes. Interesting. Interesting. Okay. So for a brief moment, I know this is about you and your book, but I just wanted to talk about myself for just a second here.
I'm going to do a terrific show today, and I'm going to help people because I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me.
Okay, Dr. Weinstein, you have a copy of your book there with you, right?
Yes, I do.
Could you go to page 123 and chapter 7 and read the title of the chapter?
Oh, I was wondering where you're going with that clip. You are special.
Okay, thank you. That chapter title really spoke to me for the last week when I've been preparing for this interview. And I'll be honest with you, I've been opening it up to chapter 7 and reading that aloud to myself. I do it when I first wake up in the morning, and then I've been opening it up throughout the day. It's my favorite page in the book. And now I have audio of you saying it, so I'm going to be able to put that on a continuous loop and just play it throughout the day. Thank you, Dr. Weinstein. I appreciate that.
You are so welcome. If you want me to send you a post-it that says that, I can sign it too.
Oh, yes, please. Oh, my goodness. So tell us then why, when it comes to scarcity, something that has a limited or restricted supply is appealing to people who are looking for prestige, respect, or uniqueness.
Yes. And so this actually, when I initially started my scarcity research, this was like one of the things I just clung to, because I'm like, that is so interesting that people who really need to feel unique need supply-related scarcity. Like, that's what they need. And so here's the thing. So there, we'll get into demand, I know, in a minute, but supply-related scarcity, it is a little bit different because it is truly a supply issue. You know, it could be intentional. So a lot of luxury brands do that. You know, they might have a drop. You know, we always hear about the drop, and my kids are into Nike, so there's always like the Nike drop. You know, they got to get their shoes. But what makes that type of thing, and these are conspicuous items, so things that we might, you know, showcase and wear and talk about or use and that kind of thing. But if there's only a certain amount of supply, it means not everyone's going to have it. So if we have it, we're special, we're different, we're unique. So this really speaks to those customers who desire to be unique in some way, that they want to have that prestige, they want to be admired, because they're not going to now be like everyone else. They're going to be different and stand out from the crowd. So luxury retailers really, really use this a lot. And you think about their distribution, you know, you can't buy some of these luxury items everywhere. Mm-hmm. There was even a lawsuit that involved, you know, Christian Dior and their fragrances within being offered, I think it was like in grocery stores or like the everyday stores, and they didn't want that because now it's not prestigious anymore and it's a supply related, you know, problem. And so it really does speak to people who want to be, you know, exclusive, unique, special. That's why I titled the chapter that. But you think about social media, you know, and what a lot of people post. I feel like that's even made this a bigger thing because people want to post and have that self-expression of like, hey, check me out. I have something you weren't able to get. And
look
so
at me.
Really
look at me.
Fall.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Oh. Well, see, I'm not going to need any of those prestige related things now because I have the audio of you saying that I'm special.
Exactly.
So
right. So I completely saved you all those purchases now too.
Thank you. The value in this book is just remarkable.
Just
so,
keeps going.
Yeah, I know. It never ends, which is funny because it's a book about scarcity. So
True.
I want to quote from page 146, back to some definitions. Scarce products are almost always considered to be of better quality and or value. Can you explain the difference between limited edition scarcity and demand-related scarcity?
Yes, and actually, limited edition is actually a part, technically, of supply-related scarcity. Mm-hmm. I pulled it out and called it as a separate one because just alone, it is so strong, you know, and it can be used differently. You know, it's not necessarily a drop. It could be something that you are just making a slight transformation on a product. So let me explain limited edition, just so we're all on the same page. I mean, limited edition, if we're talking about a product, let's say, or even a service, it's just a slight twist on the original. But it can also be a difference in the packaging. But now it's limited edition because only so many units are available. Mm-hmm. And it actually does pull a little bit of time related because it's usually for just in a certain time period. So it is truly supply versus demand because there are only so many that are going to be available to people. And so limited edition, you know, a lot of, I feel like people, they hear that and they're like, oh, but I don't sell products, so I can't use limited edition. Mm-hmm. Well, you could do service bundles. So if you have a service, you could have something that's like your bundling these services for this price for now, or that you're adding something to your normal services for just a certain time period. Now you've made something limited edition. So it doesn't have to be complicated. And I had actually interviewed in my book, Kevin Harrington, and we were talking about, for those of you, just to make sure everyone knows who he is, he's one of the original sharks from the Shark Tank.
Oh, right.
He's also the inventor of the infomercial, very, very ingrained in the home shopping networks. But he was just telling me a story of like, you know, there'd be times where, you know, it might be on, you know, the home QVC and we have this pot and pan set and we see that it sells really well. Well, when we bring it back, we'll make it a limited edition by including an additional lid. Because now it's different. And so, but then it still sells, you know? And so just like interesting things. It doesn't have to be very complicated.
Right. And one of the others you mentioned was like collaborations with other brands or companies.
Yeah. So collaborating with other brands, or so that's very easy, you know, of course, in the product space, there's been collaborations between artists, you know, where they can create some, I'm thinking of one.
Like actually, the vodka bottle, the Absolute.
Yes, yes. And I absolutely.
Back to alcohol. Oh, it's been a few minutes since we've spoken of alcohol. So
I almost said absolutely about Absolute. That sounded weird. But I was just thinking, and this is actually a local example, but just to describe it, like there is this very popular local artist in the Phoenix area. I mean, she has a huge following out here. Well, she did a collaboration with one of the stores where she went in and she actually hand painted onto Yeti cups some of her designs. So it was a limited edition. And I mean, the store was swamped. They sold out right away because it was limited edition and it was right in front of you. So it was an experience too. But there's just different things you can do to really make something stand out and speak to those people again who want to be unique and special.
Mm-hmm. Just two other questions about the book mm-hmm. before we wrap up. I want to ask you, you write that while supply-related scarcity like limited supply or limited mm-hmm. edition might seem very similar to demand related scarcity, there are some key differences. Can you explain that?
Yes. And so supply related, you know, like I said, that could be intentional, an intentional restriction of mm-hmm. some type. And it could even just be some type of supply shortage. But demand is truly that there is popularity that exists that is causing this particular product or service to be scarce.
Like the wine at the Total Wine Store.
It was in high demand.
You see how I'm absolutely. Tying it all together? Yes.
You are. See? So that story, see it? And now you know why I have a case of wine, because now we've unpacked all of these different principles here. But it truly is demand. And so for people who want to be part of a group or to conform or to be into like the hot new product or the hot new service, like they're very drawn to that. And so that's where demand related, you know, scarcity really does shine. And that's not going to work now for those, you know, the conspicuous consumption, you know, that doesn't really apply there, because conspicuous consumption, supply related, that's being special, which when you have demand related, that's, hey, I want to conform. I want to be like everyone else. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit different, but and sometimes you can't, that's one of those when it comes to, you know, a business, sometimes you can't even anticipate that. Like all of a sudden something's just in high demand. And I was even thinking this morning, I was reading an article and it was talking a lot about TikTok and TikTok influencers and how a lot of companies are having issues with supply, which is really because of high demand, but they keep running out of stock because these influencers go on there, showcase something that they're using, and now everyone wants it because it's popular, it's high demand, and they're running out. And that's really where competition comes in too. If it's high demand, there's a lot of competition going on.
Well, it also seems like it's the hardest to engineer beforehand.
Right. So yes, okay, yes and no. And so there's actually signals though. So you don't want to just manufacture high demand. That again goes with everything else we talked about. It's going to backfire. And when you think about scarcity, you want to do it ethically. And there are enough different ways to do it that you can completely be ethical. You don't need to make something up. So with high demand though, if you have a product that did just get restocked, like let people know that. And one of the examples I included in the book was actually of a jewelry designer. So she has a company. I actually included her in my fear of loss chapter, but it actually really the story falls into the demand related side is that her brand, she said she was really always nervous about running out of stock and what that would mean. And she realized though that actually being in high demand was one of their biggest assets. And so it's a jewelry brand now worth it's a multi-million dollar company. A lot of celebrities wear it. And so what would happen is that the first time that she like sent an email out to her, you know, database and said, we just restocked this item that was out of stock. Immediately they sold out again, like immediately. Uh-huh. And then all of a sudden it started being like, wait a minute. And so she knew she was on to something. And so it wasn't that she was manufacturing it, like really, like they were running out of stock. And so putting that on the website, so having restocked, doing pre-orders, doing wait lists, those are things you can do that show high demand and it's not necessarily, you know, manufactured. Well, unless you're saying it was restocked and it wasn't, like that's different. Like this all needs to be above board. But like having a wait list, let's say you have a new product you're going to roll out and you want to create a wait list excitement for that. Like that actually creates that demand related scarcity and does create excitement too. So there's things like that that you can do to incorporate it. Or like I mentioned, saying most popular, bestseller, that's actually helping your customer too, because it helps them do that mental shortcut that we talked about earlier.
Yes, but a word of caution, you write that out of all the types of scarcity, demand-related scarcity is the one most associated with deception. So it seems like you really need to be careful.
You do. And that's like all the things I've been talking about. So you can't say something is, you know, out of stock or running out when it's really not. You know, you need to always be completely above board. Again, we're smart, like we talked about, intelligent beings here. And so you don't want to, again, do anything that's not, that, or you don't want to do anything that's false. I mean, that's what it comes down to. It needs to be true, but there's enough things. Yeah, a wait list could be great, you know, that you do for something that's coming out. You know, that's a great way to do it. Builds excitement.
Yes, there have been a couple books. I think Anthony Iannarino's book, one of his, he talks about how, or and Daniel Pink talks about this as well, where in the past it was caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. But now we're in this age of information, and it's caveat venditor, meaning let the seller beware, because all you have to do is be accused of manipulating these things, and it's almost as bad as if you actually did it. So
Exactly.
Perishable stuff, that trust. So, Dr. Weinstein, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
That no matter what business you're in, or even what role that you have, that you can effectively apply scarcity to be more effective, to get more sales, to get more customers, to even just excel in your career.
To get your husband and children to do household chores.
To do laundry.
Yes.
I mean, you name it.
Well played, Dr. Weinstein. Mad respect. Mad props for you. So, well, what is one thing a listener could do today just to put in action one of the ideas from your book?
I would say your wording. Think about what wording that you're using. Mm. So, you know, sharing information. So, you know, using the word bestseller, using the word restocked, using the word limited time, you know, think about the words that you're using, because, you know, listening to the podcast, if you need to go back and rewind, you'll notice that there were a lot of words that we were using along the way that trigger scarcity. Mm-hmm. So just changing your language just a bit, that doesn't cost you money, and that you can see scarcity in action.
I love it in stores, and I think I see this at Costco, where they'll say limit 3 or limit 5. Because it's been shown, I think it's in your book as well, they showed how when you put limit 12, people will buy 12 cans of the soup.
And actually, and I didn't even mention that, but that's actually sales restrictions are a part of high demand, because you know what that tells you? You think, oh, well, people must be buying this up. Oh, I can only buy 5. I'm going to buy 5.
And even though I only wanted 1.
Right. And I mean, I see this all the time. Just walk around the grocery store and you'll see that. If there's like a people, if they're standing in front of a display that says 3 only, they will put 3 in their cart. Trust me.
Oh, people are so stupid. What am I saying? You and I both fall for these things. So
we do.
Looking back, what books have most inspired your working career?
You know, so there's a few. Okay, I'm an avid reader. I think I've read, I was trying to count how many books I read this year alone. I've probably read 35. And wow. Before everyone's like, whoa, okay. Now, some of them are fiction, because I sometimes have to let my brain just relax a little bit.
Yes, but that's great advice for the listener too. Don't,
don't
read as many as I do. Yeah.
Right. I'm definitely a book nerd, but I would say there's been a couple that when I think about like what caused me to transform some of the things that I've done, one is Building a Story Brand. And so that was a really great book. Mm-hmm. I still have it on my bookshelf, and it really helped me think about how my framing messages, you know, when I'm working with potential customers and clients. And the other one, and it was really a thought-provoking book for me, was the book Tipping Point. And so that's not necessarily a marketing book, but it really got me thinking of like what causes things to take off, and and who are those different groups of people that are part of that process. And so those are really great books. And there's a third one that, you know,
these don't have to be marketing books. Some authors have said the Bible or
Yeah. Okay. Well, now I feel bad. I should have said the Bible.
No.
I do reread my Bible. That's been very inspiring. So, that's been really inspiring for sure, too. Okay.
All right. Now I've put the guilt trip. I shouldn't have said that. I'm like, sorry.
Oh, God. Can I start over?
Yeah.
It actually, on a little note, because my son's, there was one when my son was in second grade, he goes to, private school, and they had to put what they were thankful for. And all these kids put, like, God is number one, and he put pizza, soda, and then really small, he put, oh yeah, and God, because I think he saw that everyone else was putting that. So I think that's what I just did here.
I would have put pizza. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I respect it. You know, I totally respect it.
That's that candor, that honesty, that transparency that's so important. Your son already has it. So
exactly.
So are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or are looking forward to reading?
Yeah, so I actually, we talked about Dr. Cialdini, and I would say that actually his book Influence has been very inspirational on my work and career. I mean, that's even what got me to like reach out and get to know him. You know, it was helped that he was very close. But he has a new version of the book, and I know you mentioned that too. But I have actually already read it. He added an additional influence factor into the book, and it's amazing. And what I really like about that book too is that it doesn't matter what industry you're in or what you do. So much of what he teaches in there, you can apply to anything, really. And so I definitely recommend that book. I have all his different versions, and so that's the newest one that I grabbed.
Well, I interviewed him about the book, and that is like, if a marketer or a business person, salesperson were to only read 5 books, that would be one of them. And it was twice as long as the one that he originally published in 1984, and it had all new information. And it came to mind when you were talking about the fMRI machines. Mm-hmm. He has all new case studies and even more scientific discoveries
in
the newer version. Yeah, great recommendation. Well, at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable, including all the books that you've mentioned. You've got a couple of sites, your LinkedIn profile, your Twitter account. Mm-hmm. And now a word to you, dear listener. I want to ask you a big favor. Please reach out in some way to Dr. Weinstein and congratulate her on the book. Thank her for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. Send her a message on LinkedIn or Twitter or one of her sites. Thank her for putting up with these really stupid jokes. Guests on the show have told me that they've really enjoyed hearing from Marketing Book Podcast listeners, and not just because Marketing Book Podcast listeners are so ridiculously good looking. And if you are listening on your smartphone and you subscribe to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app like Spotify or Apple Podcasts, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. Final quote, scarcity is one of the most powerful influence tactics in the world, and that power can change the course of a business and propel professional success. Let the words of Winston Churchill stay with you as you consider just how and when you might apply the incredible power of scarcity going forward. Where there is great power, there is great responsibility. The book is The Power of Scarcity, Leveraging Urgency and Demand to Influence Customer Decisions. The author is Mindy Weinstein. Mindy, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
You know what? I think this is the best show I've ever done. And you know what? I deserve it because I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. Special thanks to this episode's sponsor, Marketing Architects, creators of the all-inclusive TV advertising concept that's so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. For a copy of the book, All-Inclusive TV, How Booming Brands Are Reimagining TV Advertising, visit this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com or visit marketingarchitects.com/book and tell them you heard about it on the Marketing Book Podcast. And if you are one of the legions of listeners who have left an iTunes review, please let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast stuff. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world and I'll drop it in the mail. And remember the words of the late, great Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune."